From KCPW in Salt Lake City, I'm Jennifer Napier-Pierce, and this is City Views. Think about that cup of coffee that you drank this morning, or the shoes you're wearing on your feet. Do you know who harvested the coffee beans? Were the small-scale farmers paid a fair price? And what about the working conditions in the factory that produced your shoes? Do they meet health and environmental standards? These are among the questions that gave rise to the fair trade movement, an attempt to raise the consciousness and link the comforts we enjoy with the producers we rely on. Since fair trade emerged in the 1950s, some Western consumers have based their spending on fair trade principles. And today on the program, we're talking about fair trade locally and if it's really meeting its idealistic goals. Plus, the soulful sounds of Salt Lake musician Joel Brown. All that and your calls after the news. Good morning. I'm Jennifer Napier-Pierce, and this is City Views. From coffee to handicrafts to flowers, many consumers look for the fair trade label to ensure that the producers of these goods in developing countries are not being exploited. But does fair trade really work to lift farmers and artisans out of poverty? Today on the program, we're talking about linking consumer demand with improving lives in the developing world. And joining me this hour, Patrick Byrne. He is founder, CEO, and chairman of the online retailer Overstock.com. In 2001, he launched WorldStock, a branch of the business that sells handcrafted products from developing nations and rural America. So far, the WorldStock brand has returned 70% of its revenue to artisans and funded 26 schools internationally. Patrick Byrne joins me in studio. And Patrick, nice to meet you.
Jennifer, nice to meet you.
Also with us, Neelam Chand. She's the executive director of 10,000 Villages Utah, a fair trade nonprofit retailer located in Salt Lake City that specializes in handcrafted jewelry, textiles, and gifts. It's been named one of the world's most ethical businesses by the Ethisphere Institute for the past 5 years. Neelam Chand is with me as well. And Neelam, great to have you here this morning.
Thanks for having me here.
Later on in the program, the deeply personal music of Joel Brown. But first, fair trade. Do you think about the people behind the products that you buy? How does fair trade factor into your consumer spending? 801-355-TALK is our number. 801-355-8255, or you can send email to cityviews@kcpw.org. Before we get into your respective business models, perhaps we should first define precisely what fair trade means, because there have been variations on the theme over the decades. What is fair trade in your mind? Patrick Byrne.
Well, there's several hundred organizations that give fair trade designations, but there's a common denominator to what they believe in, is that you're going to buy from places which are not engaged in formal production. It means no kind of factory, but not a factory production, but some other less formal setting, either a workshop or home-based, and that there are certain guarantees and protections for the workers, the people making it. And in my view, in addition, it's the products themselves have some link to the native culture, some link to the tradition. There's not a sweatshop turning out identical, you know, sneakers. It's products that reflect something about the cultural tradition of the place they come from.
Neelam Chand, your take on fair trade?
Well, fair trade is a couple things. I mean, it's empowerment, it's sustainability. It's not just a product or a brand. It's more of a storytelling, especially from the background that I come from. So it's about artisans and farmers and their story and how they got there to that point to start their own businesses.
Mm-hmm. 10,000 Villages was among the first to embrace fair trade practices way back in the 1950s or so. Tell us about the nonprofit's founder, Edna Ruth Byler.
Sure. She sort of laid the foreground for fair trade in 1946. And basically what she did, she was part of a Mennonite Central Committee, and she traveled all around the world, and she noticed that women in particular were not treated fairly. They, she saw them making embroidered work, and they weren't recognized for their work. So what she did is she bought their items, brought it back to the U.S., and had her friends, family, and neighbors see some of the merchandise, and they were very amused by it. It became very popular, so she was able to sort of start this relationship with the artisans, And from there, it kind of grew. And
she started at church bazaars selling
correct.
This stuff.
It all started, actually, she was selling things from her car, her vehicle. So from there, it actually then, you know, went to churches and, you know, from her home. And now we have a storefront, which is amazing. You know, the first 10,000 villages started in 1970. So, and it just kind of grew from there. And then, of course, here locally, we've been around 10,000 villages here in Utah for 10 years.
Mm-hmm. And the core mission remains the same?
It remains the same. We've changed some of the verbiage, but it's more, I think we focus more on building the relationships with our artisans, long-term relationships. And like I said earlier, we focus on sustainability and what that actually means. So we've kind of switched. It's the same mission, you know, providing vital income for artisans all around the world. But we focus on that long-term relationship.
Patrick Byrne, you launched WorldStock in 2001, 2 years after founding Overstock. Why did you turn your attention to fair trade? I mean, why get in that business?
Well, oddly enough, I didn't even know the expression. But I was over in Cambodia, where I had visited in the late 80s, and I wanted to see how things turned out. And I was motorcycling around. And there's village after village. Cambodia has a lot of landmine survivors. And I was discovering all these villages where they had retrained the survivors as pottery wheel operators or silversmiths or this or that. And they'd picked up these crafts. And this is how Cambodia was dealing with the fact that they had about 1 million people missing body parts. And I got thinking about what was it that made it difficult for that kind of product. Why is it you never saw it in the American retail system? And I realized there were just some technicalities in the supply chain that you would need, and it wouldn't work for mass retail. And there were very few businesses that were set up to handle that kind of small lot production. And I realized that, gee, Overstock, which was, we could take this infrastructure that we had built to be an internet retailer and go out around the world and start dealing with artisans. We also have a focus or a slight preference for finding female artisans and engage them and get them to become regular suppliers. So it took a couple of years to build, to build out that chain of supply. But so it sounds like it's very similar to 10,000 villages.
The process. How do you find the artisans that you want to conduct business with, Patrick Byrne?
We have a wonderful woman, Angela Ramirez, who has really built this over the last six or seven years of its 10-year plus history. I tell her she has every woman's dream job: travel and shop. She travels all over the world. She finds the co-ops, the artisans. We also sometimes have people on the ground in different countries that we have represent us and visiting the artisans and such. But we're in about 55 countries now and have 10,000 artisans, and they generally have been found through Angela's work or other people. And then once word got out about us, we started having co-ops and artisan groups all over the world contacting us.
And so you work with co-ops and kind of the small one-person entrepreneur.
Right. The small one-person entrepreneur often has a couple family members and his or her business, and we also work with artisan groups up to about 15 or 20. So we don't want to get involved in a factory situation, but if there's 15 or 20 people who've come together, and there are lots of co-ops of artisans that can, and they're actually great to deal with because they usually have the infrastructure. Somebody has an email system, somebody has a telephone, as opposed to when you're dealing with just one artisan.
Mm-hmm. And Neelam Chand, how does the partnership work in the 10,000 villages model?
It's much like Overstock.com. How it is, our headquarters is located in Akron, Pennsylvania. We have a group of buyers that go out in the countries, and they create that one-on-one relationship with the artisans, and they find out what their living is. They find out what their stories is. They spend a lot of time with the artisans. And then what they do is they pay them 50% upfront to buy the resources and everything that they need to make the items itself. And then once the buyers, or once it's actually being shipped, they get the other 50%. So they're paid for 100%, regardless of whether we sell it here in the U.S. or not. But 75% of the artisan groups that we work with are all women. and or more than 75%. And we just keep this really close relationship, transparent and very traceable. So it all goes back. If we were ever to get audited, you know the particular artisan group that's making it. We work with about 106 artisan groups and 32 developing countries.
Speaking with Neelam Chand, Executive Director of 10,000 Villages Utah, also Patrick Byrne, the founder, CEO, and chairman of the online retailer Overstock.com, plus WorldStock, which he launched in 2001. We're talking about fair trade and about consumer decision-making. If you'd like to join us, 801-355-TALK is our number, 801-355-8255, or you can send email to cityviews@kcpw.org. So, Patrick, you mentioned fair trade certification. How important is that to you at Overstock, at WorldStock? I mean, do the artisans have to go through a certain screening process in addition to your professional shopper out there?
Yes, they there's a set of principles for WorldStock suppliers. They all have to sign up to. They sound, it's remarkably similar. The basic philosophical concept is sustainability. We want sustainable materials. We want the workers to be working in a sustainable environment where they don't get used up. And there's a whole set of principles they have to sign on to, and then they're regularly inspected. So, well, sometimes it comes, we've actually hired companies to inspect. Other times it's come from our own leaders or her buyers going out, and as they're, you know, somebody will go to Peru for a month and they'll be visiting a bunch of our artisans. So every 2 or 3 years they get visited. But there is a core set of principles dealing mostly with sustainability that define the relationship.
Mm-hmm. I guess that leads to the overriding concern of anybody who's interested in purchasing fair trade products. How do we know? Are we sure that the people who are on the receiving end of any sort of arrangement with a business like WorldStock or with like 10,000 Villages, how do we know that that money is going right to the producer? Because that seems to be, you know,
the goal.
Exactly right.
Well, I think that there the decision largely has to come down to the organization which is supplying you, if it's a legitimate firm like 10,000 Villages or I hope like to think WorldStock, that's really your best brand, your best certification and what they say, and are they being transparent or not? If they're, I mean, transparency goes hand in hand with this. Anybody who's not being transparent, you can't trust. But ultimately, the mark is going to come down to what is the retailer like who is selling this, and you make your decisions based off them. There are 200 or 300 different certifying organizations that have very different standards. In my mind, some of the standards don't mean a heck of a lot. You know, someone could still be going off and buying something for a dollar that they're coming in paying you $25 for and stuff. So they don't. So at the end of the day, it's, I think, the reputation of the organization more than any sticker you find on the product.
Do you agree with that?
I do. I do agree with that. And I think the main thing, you know, the principles of fair trade, the important one is transparency, and it's the traceability. And, you know, there's that fair trade sticker that you see, and that is the fair trade certification. But, I mean, it's like you said, it really depends on the reputation of the organization that's giving these products out mm-hmm. to the consumers. And I think it's up to our consumers to really, you know, find out more about the organization and find out more about that fair trade and what that means, and do some background research.
Well, the cynic in me says, you know, you can find fair trade coffee at Walmart, which seems to be completely counter to any fair trade principle out there. So has fair trade evolved into a marketing ploy, or is it something that consumers really can trust these days? Patrick Byrne.
Well, I would think that actually if Walmart has it, that they probably – they haven't just stuck a sticker on. They understand that there is a movement. The goal has always been to force the big guys, through the work that we're doing at the Edge to get mass adoption. And if you're going to get mass adoption, then eventually the big players are going to have to respond to this consumer preference and go send their own buyers out to Hills in Guatemala and find fair trade coffee. And there's plenty of folks out there. And then you have to make sure, well, how do you know that Walmart just hasn't found the cheap way to do it and they're going to get they've got a plantation in Guatemala. And so there you have to look at not just the Walmart, but the sticker on it and who the certifying organization is.
Mm. Patrick Byrne, he is founder, CEO, and chairman of Overstock, as well as WorldStock. Neelam Chand, executive director of 10,000 Villages Utah. We're talking about fair trade and what is fair for the artisans out there, how consumers can make good, solid, socially conscious consumer choices. If you'd like to join us, 801-355-TALK is our number, 801-355-8255. We need to take a break. We'll be right back. This is City Views on KCPW Salt Lake City. Welcome back. This is City Views. I'm Jennifer Napier Pierce. Today on the program, we're talking about the practical effects of the fair trade movement and how Utah consumers are responding to the fair trade sales pitch. Joining me this hour, Patrick Byrne, founder, CEO, and chairman of Overstock and WorldStock. Neelam Chand is with the 10,000 Villages Utah executive director of that organization. If you'd like to join us, if you have questions or comments about fair trade, how does fair trade work into your spending habits? Give us a call. 801-355-TALK is our number. 801-355-8255. Patrick Byrne, how has the internet changed retail economies and opportunities for entrepreneurs in developing nations?
Jennifer, that's a great question. In the old world, before the internet, when everything was distributed just in physical meat space, the economics of that drive everything towards mass quantities of similar goods from a small number of suppliers. Typically, Walmart only wants something if they're going to get 200,000 of it. So it's all about mass retail. What the internet has let happen is the people explore the edge of the bell curve, as they say, that, you know, small niche products, maybe you're only getting 10 or 20 or 30 from some artisan, but you can go in. The normal retail system would never work with somebody who could only produce 20, you know, items a month, because it's all set up, it's all optimized for mass. And so what the internet has let people really get into the niches and find goods from the tails of the bell curve that they can start distributing to the mass demand.
Mm-hmm. Neelam Chand, has the internet changed the 10,000 Villages business model?
Yeah, absolutely. We do a lot of our retailing online. In fact, our majority of our retailing is done online. Hmm. And we also we've been utilizing the social media because it is a very older movement. We're trying to incorporate that a little bit more to the trend that's happening now. I mean, fair trade is now hot. It's the big thing. And with the movement of green and everybody going organic, we definitely want to use the more, you know, social media to get through things. So we have Facebook, Twitter, and all sorts of different things that we could kind of communicate the message across. Mm-hmm. So.
801-355-TALK is our number. Again, we're talking about fair trade, and let's go to the phones. Mike is joining us from Salt Lake City. Maybe not. 801-355-TALK is our number. 801-355-8255. Can we talk a little bit about the demand that's out there for fair trade goods? You say it's the hot, you know, buzzword. Everybody wants to get on in this. How has fair trade demand changed over the past 5 years, 10 years? Neelam Chand.
Well, I think even now, kind of put this in perspective, fair trade compared to the larger market is like a chihuahua against an elephant. It's really small, but definitely growing. And, you know, we were talking about earlier how these big boxes like Walmart and even Starbucks and is kind of, you know, having fair trade coffee and fair trade items. I think that's a positive thing. for, you know, my stance and even our stance as an organization, because it puts that message out there. It puts that, you know, we're out there, we're fair trade. People get kind of curious about what that is. So having that in a mainstream sort of part of globalization, I think it's a big increase on awareness. So I think that's an awesome thing. I mean, and fair trade is basically a farmer's market gone global. So however that works, if that's incorporated into Walmart or Starbucks or Ben and Jerry's or wherever it is, it's out there. And that's the point. And that's never been there before. Mm. So we've definitely grown. And that proves it.
Patrick Byrne, trends over the past decade?
Sure. It's grown to be about 3% of our business. So it's about $30 million a year now. And that's up from zero 10 years ago. And it seems to be holding steady at 3% now. So I would say that that's probably indicative of, as Neelam has said, it is the Chihuahua, but it's a 3% Chihuahua. And that's up from nothing when we started it. So I think that's probably a pretty good measure of the public interest now.
What was the goal when you started? Did you think this would ever turn a profit?
Oh, yeah. I thought we could just cover ourselves. And we reached the point a few years ago that it just breaks even. The goal isn't to make money. In fact, we price everything to send as much back to the producers we can and keep a little bit left to cover the logistics and such. But we just break even. The goal is actually someday to get to 1 million suppliers. We have, you know, over 10,000 now. And if I have a real goal in the back of my mind, it's one day that this would be, you know, a billion or $2 billion business, and that we would have about 1 million suppliers employed, and that's a big goal.
Mm-hmm. What evidence is there that fair trade actually works? That it is lifting people out of poverty, that it is empowering the entrepreneur in the developing nation. What are the concrete? What is the evidence there that this is working? Neelam Chand?
Well, as I said earlier, fair trade is not a brand or a product. It's a story. And I think it's a narrative that really sort of testifies to that proof. You hear about the artisans, you talk to them. I had the opportunity, because of my line of work, to talk to the artisans and hear about their story. And
can you single one out for us? And
sure,
share
absolutely.
A story?
Yeah, I met a woman in Colombia that... pretty much had nothing, had to support her family, a young woman. They expected her to become a doctor, even though doctors don't really make much in Colombia, as they do here. They mass produce a lot of orange juice, and they kind of throw the orange peels away. And she was a very creative person, so she was able to gather all the orange peels and basically make these little dolls. And you'll have to come to the store to find out and look at them. But they're these dolls that she made, and they're very popular, little garden dolls. And she was able to employ not only herself and start this business, but to other women that also didn't really had to take care of their family. They were single, that were, not valued enough in their community. She was able to start this big business model and employ hundreds of women to make this item. And it all started from just an idea. So not only did she affect her life, but she also affected others and her family. And so, I mean, that's her coming to talk about that in the U.S. She's very thankful for that. And I mean, she's an entrepreneur. She's a businesswoman. So she's not an artisan living in a developing country. So it's very different in their perspective and hearing their stories. And I think that's important, too.
Mm-hmm. The evidence for you, Patrick Byrne, that fair trade works.
Well, that's a great question. First of all, on the theoretical level, there have been lots of experiments done in the 80s. And I used to study development economics. I remember this, that you go and raise the income of men in a village. You pick and you measure by the increase in the weight of children. And you go and increase the income of men, and you look for any difference in the weight of children, and you really get nothing. And the weight of children is a very good all-in measure of the well-being of a family or a household. But you go and you raise the income of women, and it immediately turns into this dramatic increase in the weight of children, which means that the women are investing it. They invest calories in their children. And that seems So there's good economic, in the economic literature, there's good evidence that raising the income of women is the best way to increase human utility. Now, as far as does fair trade do that, my evidence at this point, like Neelam's, is mostly anecdotal. We've had exactly the same experience as Neelam and 10,000 Villages. And I've been out there in Colombia visiting co-ops and such, and the people follow. And we get letters from thousands of artisans talking about, you know, thank you so much, and thanks to your orders, our village, you know, there's three villages in Peru who cooperate making stools for us. And we get letters saying, thanks to your orders, we can buy medicine for our children and this and that and the other thing. What we are lacking, I think, and a number of times I've spoken at universities, it would be a great subject for a economic doctoral student who wants to go out into the world and do the empirical research and then write a paper answering your question. It sure seems to me that it should work from the theory, and it sure seems to me that it does work from being out there and observing it. But what we are lacking that at this point that I know of is a good economic journal publishing a paper that looks at the evidence.
Okay, economic students out there, you've got your assignment. 801-355-TALK is our number. We're speaking with Patrick Byrne with Overstock and Worldstock and Neelam Chand with 10,000 Villages talking about fair trade and if that concept, that philosophy, influences your consumer spending. 801-355-TALK is our number. Let's go to Will in Salt Lake City. Will, hi.
Hi there.
Go right ahead.
I have a question for Patrick. You said that your fair trade products break even in your company, barely cover your costs. So what is the advantage to you as a business owner to actually carry fair trade products?
Well, just seems like, as corny as it sounds, seems like the right thing to do. Now, I know nobody believes a CEO who talks that way these days, but no, it just seemed like from the moment I recognized that the operations that we had built to handle overstocks, which tend to be bankruptcies and small amounts of 20 of this and 30 of that, once I realized that those systems could be applied to artisans, I don't know if it was curiosity or what, but I said, we have to do this. Let's build this department and see what happens. And, you know, at the end of the day, it creates our most loyal customers. What we've discovered over the years is that we're not making any money on the Worldstock stuff, but the customers who come and find us because of Worldstock come back to Overstock a lot. They're about twice as loyal as normal customers. So in that sense, the company has derived an indirect benefit.
Will, an idealistic CEO, are you buying it?
I can hear it in his voice. I appreciate it.
Thank you, Will.
Okay, Will, thanks for the call. 801-355-TALK is our number. There are some critics out there of fair trade who worry that you're missing the big picture by focusing on tiny little groups of producers, that you're missing the point on changing the larger systemic economic barriers. Wondering how you guys respond to that. Patrick Byrne first.
Oh, I say run, run, run. Run from anyone who tells you that the way to solve the world's problem is some sort of massive, coordinated, centrally planned, Stalinistic World Bank top-down approach. The things that work are bottoms-up, microfinance, getting women, raising the income of women, working with small lots. Anybody who says that stuff, they just come at it from the big organizational approach. And that's been a failure. I think that for 50 years, the aid that the West has provided the developing world has been at best break even and may have been pernicious. There's a whole school of thought among economists that has actually caused more harm than it's helped. The only things that work, in my experience, are things that are small scale, bottoms up.
Neelam Chand?
I agree with that wholeheartedly. And I mean, if you think about globalization and what that's done, as far as, you know, we have mass production, you know, and that's great, I guess. But then you also have the behind the scenes, you have children that are working their butts off, really, to make these items just for you. And I think starting off a little bit smaller and really thinking about what social justices and what economic justices is starting from a fair price, is treating the people that are producing this mass production fair and paying them what they deserve. We get paid what we deserve, otherwise we don't. And if we don't, we react to it. And that's a negative part of it. So if we, you know, we pay hourly fairly and we pay what they, you know, deserve, then I think that can grow. It's a positive seed that will flower into something, I guess, as cheesy as that sounds.
801-355-TALK is our number. Let's go back to the phones. Kim is joining us from Layton. Kim, hi.
Hi.
Go right ahead.
Oh, you may have answered the question with that last statement, but my question was, as a consumer, should we be wary of companies? I mean, like, The Body Shop is one of those that's a bigger one that does the fair trade. There's symbols everywhere on the products that they get from other countries. Should we be wary of big corporations like that are promoting this fair trade, as far as maybe they aren't paying back the people that are making these goods for us fairly, and the company is keeping the bulk of the profit? I mean, I know it's a company and their bottom line is money, but should we be wary of companies like this that maybe are a little bit exploitive of the people that are making these goods for us?
I think Kim reflects that insecurity the consumers mm-hmm. feel. Like, they see the fair trade, they want to do the right thing, but can they have an assurance that it's going back into communities? Neelam Chand.
Well, I will say that there are a lot of, you know, like the Fair Trade Federation, they are, their job is to kind of do the auditing. It's to find out, you know, what is fair trade, what isn't. I mean, the certification process is such a complicated process because of the amount of money it takes to actually create a program for that. But so far, I mean, we have a couple different organizations out there, and you can even look online, that help control some of those things. I think the big companies like The Body Shop and, you know, Walmart, they are also controlled by some of that too. They have to back it up. They, when you have auditors come in, and I'm sure they get this all the time because they are big, questioning their sincerity of fair trade and what that is, they have to back it up. There's no other way. And so I mean, consumers can challenge that, and I think they shouldn't encourage them to continue challenging that is it really fair trade and what that looks like and is that transfer, you know, transparency there. So I mean, that's a vague answer, but it has a lot to do with the consumer doing research as well as the resources that are out there. There's quite a bit.
Mm-hmm. And Patrick, you mentioned there are a lot of certification programs out there. Are there some more trustworthy than others?
Well, not that I know of, not that I can name offhand, but what I can say is, well, that's a very plausible concern for your caller to have, that look at it from my point of view. The worst thing that could possibly happen for Overstock would be for 60 Minutes to show up and say, aha, we found this pot that you're selling from Guatemala that you say is fair trade, but we traced it back and there's actually a factory with, you know, children, blah, blah, blah. And that would be the worst thing that could possibly happen. So by doing fair trade, or saying that you're doing fair trade, you're really hanging your reputation out there. And because that would be the worst thing that could possibly happen, we're really on that. We're really, I mean, anything's possible. If you got 1,000 suppliers, someone can always cheat you or lie to you or something. But we are really on that. And I would expect even Walmart and is the same. They understand that they're really hanging their reputation out, that if 60 Minutes does a story that Walmart's fair trade coffee is actually, you know, isn't, that it, 'cause it's super damaging to the reputation. And so because they're hanging themselves out, I bet they're giving it a lot of scrutiny internally. Lord knows I don't want to defend Walmart. I'd much prefer you shop with Overstock. But if, but that is actually, I can understand why the consumers would be afraid. But I think that if it's a legitimate retailer, they're probably taking an awful lot of care if they're using the term fair trade, because they know the really bad publicity that would come if they cheated.
Mm-hmm. And just to piggyback off of that, there was Ben and Jerry's, actually, there was an article written about them where they claimed to be fair trade because they had a couple different ingredients in their ice cream that was fair trade ingredients. So they claimed overall that they're fair trade. Well, the media and our consumers definitely, you know, sort of harped them on that and asked, you know, how is that fair trade when you only have a couple of different ingredients? So then they were able to differentiate, you know, what is fair trade ice cream from what isn't fair trade ice cream. They had to do that. The media had to force them to do that. Like you said, because you're so big and you're in front of the media's eyes, you're kind of forced to kind of back up what you own, what you're putting out there. So
our time is short. I want to just end with this finally. I mean, the cost of fair trade, I remember hearing a story on NPR about a small company in Australia that was trying to do the socially conscious thing and not go to the factory workers in China to produce a sneaker line. But the cost was really high for these shoes. It was like $200 a pair. So for the consumers out there, does doing the right thing mean spending more money? I mean, paying a higher price, a premium, to make sure that this product is produced in an environmentally and a socially conscious way? Neelam Chand.
I think with the items that 10,000 Villages has and other organizations overstock, they are, to say that they would be a high price for the value and the amount of work that is put into it, I even think that, you know, the prices that we even put on it is still lower than what they're actually worth. Because if you actually go back and, you know, like I said, pick up that orange peel, you know, doll, or you look at the coffee, the quality of the coffee, there's a lot more value put onto that, you know, because of the hard work that's put into it. So if consumers are feeling that they're paying a little bit more of a higher price, really take a look at what you're buying. You're not buying a low quality item. You're buying something that's going to last you, that has a story behind it, that can be traced back to a different country. So of course, yeah, you can go to the country itself and buy it for cheaper, but you're also, I mean, you're not really consciously buying, and you're, and of course there's higher cost to things that are valued more. So I mean, that's just what it is. It's expensive because it's the value of it is expensive. So mm-hmm.
Patrick Byrne.
I'd say well, it's, you are getting something. First, if you want to get something that's mass produced in a sweatshop in Indonesia by a woman chained to a machine, you can do it. Go buy a pair of sneakers, and that's and you're getting one type of object. But the types of things that you get through fair trade typically aren't competitive. It isn't even the same products that you're going to get from mass production in a factory. They're more traditional. Sometimes it's otherwise. For example, you can go, there's around the Navajo Reservation. We used to do a lot of good business there. And on the rim of the Navajo Reservation, there are different Anglo towns, as they call them, with trading posts. But you go in there and buy some stuff, and unless you ask specifically, often what you're getting is stuff that was made in Pakistan, made to a Navajo design. Now, if you ask them, I have surprisingly found the storekeepers honest about, if you know to ask them, and they'll tell you, well, this actually came from Pakistan. It's a law if they don't. It's a crime if they don't. But so the question is, if you wanted a nice turquoise necklace, would you rather have it made, you know, to traditional Navajo design by a Navajo elder, or would you rather have a knockoff that was made in Pakistan? So that's got to enter your moral calculation.
Mm-hmm. Patrick Byrne is founder, CEO, chairman of Overstock as well as Worldstock. Thanks very much for your time today. I appreciate it.
Thank you, Jennifer.
And Neelam Chand, executive director of 10,000 Villages Utah. Thanks to you as well.
Thank you.
Up next, we're speaking with Joel Brown on getting personal, but first a break. This is City Views on KCPW Salt Lake City. Welcome back. I'm Jennifer Napier Pierce, and this is City Views. From the divorce of his parents to his own paralysis from the chest down at age 9, Joel Brown isn't afraid of putting his vulnerabilities and emotions on display through his music. The singer-songwriter is featured in this month's installment of KCPW's Sounds from the Lounge. He joins me now in studio. And Joel Brown, thanks very much for your time today.
Thank you, Jennifer Napier Pierce.
Joel Brown, he's been writing and performing music since he was 15, a native of Magna?
Magna.
Hey, so am I.
Nice.
His first album, In Retrospect, came out last year. His latest project, From the Dance Studio, will be released April 28th. If you'd like to join us, 801-355-TALK is our number. If you have questions or comments for Joel Brown about his music, 801-355-8255, or send email to cityviews@kcpw.org. Joel Brown, since your songs really delve into some very intensely personal issues, I'm going to dive right into your personal life.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
You're now 23, but your life changed when you were age 9. What happened?
I was fishing and swimming at Utah Lake with some of my older siblings and a couple cousins. So we were all young, just kids. The oldest was 18, and I was the youngest. I was 9. And we got in a car accident on the way home. My brother accidentally ran a stop sign, and so we got T-boned. So I spent a couple of months at Primary Children's. My level of injury is T4, so yeah, right at the chest. And had some other injuries, like I lost a kidney and broke an arm. And, you know, but all in all was fine. And I was the worst one hurt. You know, nobody died. Nobody was long-termly injured. But it was fine. I had, you know, tons of family support. And you know, I always had a good attitude. And I played a ton of sports and danced before the injury, and then after the injury, I continued to do tons of sports and you know, and play.
Mm-hmm. So it didn't change your interests at all.
Well, I was 9. My interest as a 9-year-old was to play. So no. But
I think for a lot of people that could be devastating. I mean, you would just say, okay, you know, I can't do what I did before. How did you maintain your optimism?
Well, you know, there are lots of, we call them like, maybe they're called healing stories, things you tell yourself when you get hurt. You know, to my 9-year-old self, I was surrounded by love and family and support. And also even, you know, my church and the beliefs that it had, it gave me a healing story. And you know, maybe the naivety of being 9 and also, you know, there's, okay. So there was I didn't know what it meant to be paralyzed. I've never heard of that before. But there was a time when I knew I was handicapped, you know, very early on in the ICU. And the only handicapped people I'd ever seen were like very kind of grotesque people, or really, really fat people, you know, in these power wheelchairs. I thought that I looked different. I knew that I was handicapped, so I thought I would be different somehow. And I asked the nurse for a mirror because I hadn't seen myself in maybe a week. And I got this mirror, and I looked at the mirror, and I was exactly the same. Mm. And I'd never been more attracted to myself. Just joke. I was gorgeous. Anyway, so I knew that I was still me.
Mm-hmm.
And I had some good mentors. Mike Schlappi is a pretty big Utah name. He's a paraplegic. He was a gold medalist in wheelchair basketball, and he came and he visited me. And he and I have similar injuries, but I saw his life, and you know, he was successful. He had a great job. He was a great basketball player, which at the time was the only thing I cared about. Like, he had a house, you know, cute wife, kids. So, you know, it was maybe natural to have a good attitude for me. So,
So when did music enter the picture?
When music always enters the pictures, when you're in junior high school and you don't have anything to do. I got really good at Nintendo and guitar. Yeah.
Describe for us that songwriting process, though. I mean, not everybody who fools around with a guitar succeeds in writing lyrics and songs that are meaningful and beautiful. For you, does it start with a tune? Does it start with a chord or a story to tell? How does it work?
Usually I have to have something to say. If I don't have something to say, I have a hard time writing something. But my process really is pretty boring. And I've written 9 dumb songs or more, 20 dumb songs to every decent song. So the process for me isn't really that interesting. I sit on a guitar and I kind of improvise and play around.
Well, we're yakking way too much. I want to hear your songs. Let's talk about Lullaby. Before we play part of this, give us the backstory on Lullaby.
When I was a kid, my mother wanted me to go to bed, and I didn't want to. And she would tell me how my pillow would be so sad if I wouldn't go to bed, and that my pillow would be crying because it wanted me to, it wanted my attention. I took those kind of stories and reversed it because, you know, as an adult, or maybe the first time you hear your parent cry, it shatters your perception of them a little bit. And so I wrote this after my mom's dad died, just for her, because I wanted her to go to bed. So I took those kind of stories and synthesized them.
This is Joel Brown, Lullaby.
I won't go to bed until I've read, until my mother's face isn't wet. With silent tears, her lips haven't been kissed in years. So I'll kiss your cheek, Mother.
It's Joel Brown, a live studio recording from KCBW's lounge right here on Library Square. This is a song that, you know, it's very touching. I mean, how did your mom respond to it when she heard it?
She liked it. There are a couple lines that embarrass her, I suppose, because, you know, I really exposed her, but she likes it.
As any mother would, I'm sure. Joel Brown, you've studied music at the University of Utah. Who are your musical interests or influences?
Rufus Wainwright, Ben Folds, Damien Rice, just kind of singer-songwritery, people like that.
Has your music evolved as you've been studying?
Yeah. But maybe just by getting older, I mean... The music, right when you're 16, is not very good, and same. And now I'm only 23, so now my music is just kind of getting barely listenable now.
I don't know if many would agree with that, but you do have a new album coming out later this month. I want to play a clip from this new album. Describe for us before we hear it. Aren't You Glad You're Mine?
The new record is not nearly as depressing or personal as my last record, which is on iTunes. But it's really fun.
Okay, well, let's listen to this. This is Joel Brown, and Aren't You Glad You're Mine?
I say it to myself, I say it all the time. I say it all the time. Aren't you glad you're mine? I say it to myself, I say it all the time. I say it all the time. Aren't you glad you're mine? Aren't you glad you're mine? Oh, aren't you glad you're mine?
Sounds like you're in love. Is this a love song?
Sure.
Sadly, our time is running out, but I understand you're moving to Oakland to join a contemporary dance company. How does that
work?
That's
right. Well, my mother was a dancer. She's got her master's degree, and my father was a gymnast, and we all grew up in my family dancing and doing gymnastics. And my older brother, he and his wife are both professionals. She danced for Rodney Woodbury here in Salt Lake for many years. He's in grad school in Maryland. And I've done... some work with my older brother, and it's fantastic. The work, we called it The Better Half. You can search my name and The Better Half on Vimeo and see a really awesome dance. And I'm just very mobile. I love to get on the ground and crawl around, and you know, I love to move. Dance isn't what I've studied, but it's, you know, I like I said, I like to move. anyway, so I did work with my brother. And then there's a company in Oakland called Axis Dance, and they are a mixed ability company. And they've been around for 25 years. And they saw my work and offered me a job, basically. And so I'm moving to dance with Axis for a couple of years at the end of this month.
Clearly your paralysis isn't holding you back from any ambition.
No, I mean, there's nothing. We live in a world, at least in our country, things are very accessible. You know, everything. I have romance, job, you know, independent kids. I don't have kids. But, you know, everything is, you know, possible.
It's possible. Singer-songwriter Joel Brown, his latest project From the Dance Studio will be released April 28th. And thanks very much for your time today.
Thank you.
Say it all the time, I say it all the time. Aren't you glad you're mine?
I say it to myself. And again, you can check out Joel Brown's music on the Sounds from the Lounge page at our website, kcpw.org. City Views is a production of KCPW News in Salt Lake City. Thanks to Tamara Kemsley, Katie Sheen Abbott. Our technical director is Jesse Ellis. We had help today from Eric Ray. Next time, the latest on the Ski Link proposal and your calls. Hope you'll join us for that tomorrow. For City Views, I'm Jennifer Napier Pierce.